Money FM 89.3, best of your money. Money and Me on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
Welcome to Money and Me. I'm Michelle Martin. In the news, headlines screaming about cryptocurrencies and their meteoric rise. The market cap of Bitcoin and other cryptos topped $1 trillion last week. Bitcoin has surged nearly 300% over the past 12 months. There's been a flurry of excitement as Square, PayPal, MassMutual and other companies bring Bitcoin into their fold, widening the possibility for broader adoption. There's been institutional inflows into Grayscale and retail buying. Take a look, though, at CryptoQuant's total miner outflow charts, and you see strong selling interest from Bitcoin miners in January this year, reaching highs last seen in January 2018. Are we in the midst of a sustained sell-off? Could we be in the midst of a potential bubble burst amongst cryptocurrencies? And should that happen, which cryptocurrencies could survive or even thrive? One Bitcoin, by the way, equals $43,758.86 Singapore cents this morning. I think when it comes to trying to understand cryptocurrencies, problem is for many people, even the basics aren't understood. So that's what we're going to look at as well. My guest is Jeremy Ng, Managing Director of Gemini for APAC. Gemini is a private licensed digital asset exchange. It was launched in 2015 in the US by Cameron and Tyler Winklevoss, and it's now expanded its operations to Europe and Asia, and it is live here in Singapore. It allows customers to buy, sell, and store cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, Ether, Litecoin, and Zcash. Jeremy, good morning.
Good morning, Michelle. How are you?
I'm doing really well. Thank you so much for joining us. So first up, you know, I even have people asking basics like, where can I buy one Bitcoin? So I want to ask you, would I be able to buy Bitcoin, or am I actually buying Bitcoin Cash on Gemini?
Sure. Well, you know, first of all, not only you can buy one Bitcoin, which actually it is quite expensive, you know, in terms of the quantum, like you mentioned, is over $45,000 or, you know, US $33,000, $34,000. I think the interesting thing is, you know, Bitcoin you can buy in a fraction down to 8 decimal place. So literally you can buy $1 worth of Bitcoin if you want. And on our exchange, you know, you can look at like, you know, more than 15 different kind of cryptocurrencies. And you mentioned about Bitcoin Cash. Mm. So Bitcoin Cash is actually also another form of cryptocurrency and blockchain. But it differentiates itself from Bitcoin by being able to process more transactions. So essentially, in a very geeky crypto term, Bitcoin Cash is basically a fork of Bitcoin. And technically quite similar.
Isn't it already sort of like a fraction of Bitcoin? Is it a fraction of Bitcoin, a very, very small amount of Bitcoin, or is it sort of an offshoot of Bitcoin?
Oh, it is the same Bitcoin. So, for example, if you look at Bitcoin, you know, I think a lot of people have a bit of misconception that like stock, like Apple or like Tesla, you know, you have to buy minimum in one share and then, you know, so on and so forth. But for Bitcoin, you don't have to buy one full Bitcoin. You can buy in fraction. You can buy 0.1, you can buy 0.001, you know, up to 8 decimal place. So I think that is the beauty of the whole blockchain technology and cryptocurrency, is that, you know, it brings this internet money, I call it, down to, you know, to everyone. So we call it, you know, we can bank the unbanked. So essentially, you know, you don't have to have, you know, a huge amount of wealth to be able to have an ownership of cryptocurrency, or Bitcoin in this case, and you know, it's for everyone and anyone.
Okay, but now we see Wall Street joining the party in the big way. You know, original thesis, Bitcoin, help the unbanked, a frictionless payment system, maybe even a currency substitute, and then it morphed into this idea of a monetary system, you know, sort of free from institutional influence. And that thesis seems to keep evolving, the story gaining momentum. A lot of people very excited when they saw Bitcoin rising near 42,000, but we did see a recent pullback. So Jeremy, what do you think explains Bitcoin's rise so far?
Sure. In fact, you know, I hear even at your introduction, you mentioned, you know, quite a fair bit of you know, companies or institutions that has gotten involved. So I think the way I look at it is, especially, you know, since maybe September, October, you know, when Bitcoin started to stabilize, you know, from the March low, and then, you know, crossing the 20,000, which was a very historical resistance level, because that 20,000 was the previous high, end of 2017, beginning of 2018, you know, before obviously the winter of cryptocurrency over the 2018 and 19. And when that 20,000, you know, barrier was broken, then we saw a very quick rise, you know, even up to 40,000, 41,000 over a very short period of time. And a lot of it is really driven by institutional participation. So if you look at, you know, in the last couple of months, you know, there are companies like MicroStrategy, which is a NASDAQ-listed company, mm-hmm. who has very boldly invested the full amount of their corporate treasury that was worth about $425 million, you know, all into Bitcoin, you know, back when it was about less than 12,000. And then subsequently, they actually raised a bond issuance of $650 million to around that level to be all invested into Bitcoin, you know, because of the strong conviction that the U.S. dollar is no longer a good store of value for them. I can touch a little bit more on that thesis a bit later. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we look at Square. They have a cash app in the U.S., and that app has been enabling their users to trade in cryptocurrency. And we saw that, you know, in the last quarter of 2020, there was $1.6 billion of volume that was traded across on that cash app, which is mostly just retail users. Mm. And then I think the most exciting thing was back in November when PayPal offered crypto trading to 390 million of their user base, and also allowing crypto to be used as a form of payment for purchases. I think that is really huge. You know, when you have big companies like that coming out to use crypto as an agent for making payments, I think that really gives a lot of legitimacy to cryptocurrency. Now, obviously, you know, when you talk about Wall Street coming in, so Wall Street analysts and, you know, JP Morgan, Citibank, you know, they all kind of jump on the bandwagon, you know, from calling cryptocurrency a fraud to now, you know, having research team that, you know, put up certain forecasts. I think JP Morgan was saying 180,000, and Citi was giving an even higher number, like over 300,000. Mm. So I think, you know, a lot of these are real money flow, because institutions and corporates are actually investing into cryptocurrency. And I think a lot of that, you know, is really the driving force behind, you know, where we see how the market has moved over the last 3 months. Now, I'll just stop here first before I babble too much.
No, that's fine. Keep babbling. It's really interesting. I think because there's so many conflicting headlines out there, you know, Jeremy, on the one hand, you hear, okay, UK's financial regulator issued a warning about crypto and Bitcoin, and they said mm-hmm. people should be prepared to lose all your money. On the other hand, as you say, you do have JP Morgan jumping in, predicting, you know, over 130,000 as their target price for Bitcoin. But then real people are also reading the headlines saying that the U.S. has approved a Bitcoin exchange-traded fund, you know. So there's a lot of conflicting headlines, and I think that leads to a misunderstanding about what really Bitcoin is, what really are the drivers behind cryptocurrency. So there's a lot there to unpack. First of all, what do you think are the real risks of investing in cryptocurrency?
Sure. I think, you know, like all asset classes, you know, investment always carries risk. I think it's just a matter of, you know, whether it's a higher risk or lower risk. And just that we learn in Finance 101, you know, higher risk will give you higher return. So equities will always give a higher long-term return over bonds or fixed income, because the risk metric is very different. So to be fair, you know, cryptocurrency in an asset class, you know, if I can call it that, is only about 10 years, right? So it is still an asset class that is maturing. And for any new asset class, there will always be trading at a higher volatility. And the volatility will slowly, you know, come down as more and more institutional players come in. Because typically, you know, when it was mostly crowded by retail investors, which is what we have seen, you know, back in, say, 15, 16, 17, 18, right, in the hike of that, it is mostly retail investors that have been driving the price action. And retail investors are in a way, can be a little bit more fickle. And so, you know, when things are doing well, they jump in. When things are not doing well, they will get out. And that led to a lot of volatility. So the way I look at it is, you know, as we are seeing more and more institutions, you know, participating, typically, you know, these guys are much longer term horizon. They've done their homework. They've done a lot of homework over the last few years. I can assure you, I've been involved in so much of this conversation, providing analysis and whatnot. So when they finally decided to pull the trigger, they're not in it for 1 month trade, 3 month trade, 6 month trade. They're not. They're really looking at this as, okay, this has 2x, 3x, or 5x potential, and we are putting an allocation to that, and it will be part of our portfolio. It's got return perspective. It's got a diversification perspective. So they are stronger hands. So as more and more such institutional players going to come into the market, then the volatility will be dampened just because there's going to be less of such speculative trading. Now, what are the risks? You know, clearly, if you're an investor, you know, listening to this and you want to, you know, invest and allocate, obviously, you always need to understand that, you know, that there's always going to be volatility and it's always going to be risk and nothing is going to move up, you know, one direction, right? So my suggestion, I'm not a financial advisor and I'm not providing any investment advice here, but at least from a personal standpoint, I'll look at my whole portfolio as a full portfolio construction and how much I want to allocate into cryptocurrency. It could be 2%, it could be 5%. For some people, it could be 20%. But I think, you know, it has to be with the mindset that, you know, this thing can drop 20-30% overnight, and it has been doing that. But I'm personally looking at it over a very long-term horizon because I look at cryptocurrency as a new store of value. So that really relates to the whole macro trend now. You look at what the Fed has been doing, just to kind of put some numbers, right? Mm-hmm. You know, since the global financial crisis, 2009 until about beginning of last year, before the pandemic, the Fed had already expanded their balance sheet, you know, three times, okay, from about $550 billion to $1.6 trillion. And then we enter COVID-19 since March. And then over the next 6 months, you know, from March, the Fed increased the supply of U.S. dollar in circulation, or we call M2, right, you know, by economists, by another $3 trillion. And of that, about one-third of that was printed, about $1.1 trillion was printed. So what that is telling us is the Fed has printed two-thirds as much money in that six-month period as it did over the prior 11 years since the global financial crisis. And then on top, there's this $2 trillion stimulus package and whatnot. So essentially, there's so much of money printing that I just can't see, you know, how the U.S. dollar wouldn't devalue. And because of the devaluation, it would be inflationary. And that's why people are looking for hedges. And you see gold prices going up, silver prices going up. And cryptocurrency is another form of inflation hedge. And I think, you know, our founders, the Winklevoss brothers, you know, they published an article October last year in the calling 500,000 case for Bitcoin. And actually, if you look at it, you know, their stance is not so much, you know, whether Bitcoin will hit 500,000. Mm-hmm. Their stance is more when. It's just a sooner or later. And they draw comparison, you know, Bitcoin versus gold and calling Bitcoin basically a digital gold or gold 2.0. And for very good reason, right? You know, you look at gold, why we choose gold to be a store of value historically, because it's scarce. And if you look at Bitcoin, it is actually even more scarce because there is a limited supply of 21 million. So essentially, you know, Bitcoin the supply of Bitcoin cannot exceed 21 million. Because of the computer code that was written, you know, by Satoshi Nakamoto, and so that's one. It's fixed supply, and number two, it is more durable. It's a software. Right? It's internet money. It's not like gold is hardware.
Let me just pick up on that point of scarcity or limited supply. So when people hear of an Apple stock split or a Tesla stock split, I think what comes to mind, maybe for the retail investor, is could this happen to Bitcoin? Could Bitcoin undergo a division? And how would that work? Is there such a thing as a Bitcoin stock, you know, stock in inverted commas split?
Sure. I think that's a good point. Now, when stock go for a stock split, it is typically because the price per share has gone up so high that it becomes less accessible to investors, right? For example, you know, that's what happened to Apple, to Tesla. Mm-hmm. Now, but the supply of that, you know, didn't increase, right? It is still the same. It's just that now, instead of Apple trading at 200 per share, they make it to become 100 per share, but then increase the number of shares.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So for Bitcoin, there is no need for so-called a split because, as I mentioned earlier, because of its ability that it is actually already divisible over 8 decimal places. So as it is now, you don't have to split Bitcoin in order for it to be more accessible because you can actually buy in fraction. You don't have to buy one full Bitcoin. If you only have $10, then you can just buy a small fraction of the Bitcoin that's worth $10. And anyone can do that. So I think that is a beauty. There's no need for any so-called stock split, per se.
Okay, so it's already transparent then, this lack of a need for. Then when we talk about scarcity of Bitcoin, help us then understand the halving, which basically reduces the amount of reward a miner gets, right? It has nothing to do with the total amount of Bitcoins in the system, does it?
That's correct. So it is not. It doesn't affect the total amount or total supply, but it just affects the reward that the miner is getting. So that, you know, the halving is essentially how the supply can be controlled, that the supply will get less and less and less. So by about 2040, it will be close to full supply or full 21 million being mined in the system.
Okay. All this is important, understanding scarcity and supply, because I think investors are trying to understand and figure out where the discharges are, especially when they see such, you know, almost a monopoly of Bitcoin from funds like Grayscale Bitcoin Trust. And I just want to come back to the ETF I mentioned earlier. So there are people out there saying the US approval of that Bitcoin exchange traded fund could actually weigh on Bitcoin's price, at least in the short term. You know, would you agree?
Actually, to me, I welcome, you know, ETF. I'm not sure whether, you know, has the SEC approved any ETF in the U.S. yet. They're definitely, you know, under consideration. But I'm actually, you know, personally hoping for more ETFs to be approved across not just U.S., but, you know, even hopefully one day in Singapore, because there are still investors that are not accessing, you know, Bitcoin directly, even though they could, but for maybe lack of understanding or lack of comfort, they still prefer to go through, you know, the medium that they're most familiar with, which is in the equity market, where ETF is traded. So if ETF is eventually going to be allowed to be traded in the bigger exchanges, that would actually drive more demand. Because at the end of the day, you know, for any ETF issuer, for every ETF that they issue, they need to back with the actual underlying.
And, so you don't think that the exchange-traded fund, if it is approved, I mean, the Securities and Exchange Commission expected to approve the ETF this year, but if that does happen, you don't think that's going to pull investors and erode a key support of cryptocurrency's lofty price? And see outflows from Grayscale, where institutional investors are?
Oh, well, there might be outflow from some of the other funds into the ETF, but, you know, if you ask me in terms of where Bitcoin prices would be, it will actually be supportive. Because for every new ETF that is being issued, then that you need to buy the underlying. So it's just like we buy, let's call it S&P 500 ETF.
Mm-hmm.
So when people buy the S&P 500 ETF, the issuer of the ETF actually need to hedge with the underlying S&P futures or the 500 stocks in S&P, because then they need to give the same performance, right, you know, to the investors through the ETFs. So in this case, more people buying ETF actually means more more buying off the underlying, which is Bitcoin itself.
All right.
So it's going to be supportive. Mm-hmm. It's going to be supportive.
Okay. Still, as you yourself mentioned, extremely volatile asset, so to speak. It slumped, sliding as much as 15% to 32,400 just earlier this week. And I was reading Mark Cuban, you know, he's a billionaire investor, and he said watching cryptos trade is exactly like the internet stock bubble. And what he meant was that he sees some surviving better than others. He said he sees Bitcoin and Ether surviving the bubble bursting and thriving, but that many others won't. So I want to ask you, do you think we are in the middle of some sort of stock bubble and that Bitcoin is likely to survive and Ether as well, but some of the other coins won't?
Well, first of all, I do not agree that it is a bubble. That's for one. And I think, you know, kind of going back to why my founders, you know, think that, you know, you can kind of get to 500,000 is it's actually a very simple math, right? You look at gold, which is currently at about 9 to 10 trillion market cap, and you know, compared to Bitcoin, which I've earlier mentioned that, you know, could be potentially a better version of gold, it is only at about 600 billion market cap. So for it to become like gold at the same market cap, you know, that is about 500,000. But if Bitcoin is actually a better version of gold, then it should actually exceed that 500,000. Compared to where we are now at 32,000, it is we're definitely not in the bubble stage. And in terms of, you know, all the different cryptocurrencies out there, yes, I think, you know, they all serve a different purpose, and I can't comment which one will survive or not, but I would say that, you know, Bitcoin and Ether are the two largest by market cap, and I personally, you know, have the biggest allocation on these two, Bitcoin first and then Ether, but you know, but a lot of the other coins, you know, have its own purpose. For example, in DeFi, there's a lot of DeFi tokens that has gained a lot of interest, but whether, you know, all of them are going to survive or not, then I will see that not all things are created the same. So, but I can't give any specific, you know, which one or not would do well on.
We'll have to get you on in another show for that one and pick your brains on that. All right. So there are a lot of concerns over security when it comes to, you know, buying cryptocurrency. And I wonder how your exchange, Gemini, Jeremy, addresses some of these concerns. I understand you can buy Ethereum, you can buy Gemini, you can transfer Bitcoin to another exchange to buy altcoins through Gemini as well. But in order to use Gemini, you have to fund your account via an international money transfer, right? So how do you address concerns over security when it comes to those transfers?
Sure. So first of all, to sign up on Gemini, it is extremely simple. It's almost less than 2 minutes because we're recently integrated with MyInfo. So for any new user, you know, you download our app, you click sign up, and you log into your SingPass, and, you know, your particulars will be downloaded, you know, via MyInfo, and then you click OK. It's literally less than 1 minute, and then you are onboarded. So that's step one. And then step two, in terms of, you know, sending your funds into Gemini account is also very simple. So we now are able to offer SingDollar via fast transfer. So all you need to do is to link up to your local bank account, and then you can do a fast transfer.
Okay, and how do I cash out?
Exactly the same way. The same bank that's being linked, you can deposit, and you can also withdraw back to the same bank.
Okay, I think that's important. All right, yeah. Jeremy, it's been very informative. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
No, thank you for the privilege. Have a good day.
You too. Jeremy Ng is Managing Director of Gemini APEC. They are a regulated digital asset exchange launched back in 2015 in the US. They've since expanded to Europe and Asia and are live here in Singapore. I'm Michelle Martin. Thanks for joining me on Money and Me.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SBH Radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.